So welcome everyone to Howling Coyote. And today I'm honored to have Lisa Sakabason joining me. She's the co-chief executive officer of Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness and is a person who does amazing things for the communities that in which she works. And so Lisa, would you like to say anything more about yourself or your background or I know you're Pescana Makati. I've learned how to say it properly. So anything else you want to say?
First, I want to say Chi Williwin, which is a big thank you to you, Dr. Mal Madrona, for asking me to join you. Whenever we have an opportunity to talk about the amazing work at Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness, I love to be in those spaces. So thank you for creating this space. As you said, I am Passamaquoddy, which is what you probably heard before. I was going to say it the other way. So, but what you've probably heard before, if you've heard of our tribe, is Passamaquoddy. And I am a citizen of the Passamaquoddy tribe of Madotmaguk, which is Indian Township, a small community not far from the Canadian border, located in our traditional homelands of what we now call Maine. And it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. So I was thinking it would be really wonderful to describe the process that you've gone through since you came to Wabanaki Health, Public Health and Wellness in terms of building an organization and the projects that are near and dear to your heart and where you've come from and then we'll get to where you want to get to.
Yeah. So the beginning of the work, I joined the team. It will be 4 years ago in May. And I joined the team shortly after my father transitioned. My father, his name is Alan Sakabason. He was a Passamaquoddy tribal chief when I was a child. He was very active in language restoration, revitalization. His first spoken language was Passamaquoddy. When he passed, it was a transformative time for me. I had been working in systems, essentially systems of oppression. I've been working in systems of academia, systems of government, systems of philanthropy. And when my dad was passing, he said to me that he had so much more that he wanted to do, so much more that he believes that we as Indigenous people could accomplish. And that was really all centered around bringing culture back to our community in a real centered way, as well as language. And what he believed is that that would restore our wellness, that would reconnect us to the healing that already was inside of us. And so when he passed, I did an inventory, a personal inventory of where I was spending my time, how I thought I was making meaningful impact and working in those systems of oppression and doing my best to shift those systems, while always acknowledging that we already have the way in our communities. We already know the way, which is we all have a role. No role is greater than the other. So me as the chief executive officer of this big organization is no more important than any other person in our organization or community. That each role is vital in creating whatever it is we wanted to create. So I left my job at that time in philanthropy, joined Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness. I was team number 7. We are now 107, less than 4 years later. And we started working together and dreaming. We started thinking about what could we create without thinking about limitations. What is it that we already know and hold as just that intrinsic knowledge that we have as Indigenous people? And so our work was really coming together, letting everyone know that they have a role and we want to hear their voice. We create at Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness, we create a lot of consortiums or wisdom keepers, groups of individuals that can help in the creation of whatever it is we're creating. So what we did at Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness is we brought together tribal leadership. We brought together, and that includes chiefs and vice chiefs and tribal councils, as well as department heads like health directors and educational directors, domestic violence coordinators, and alike. And we started having the conversation about what does healing look like? What does wellness look like? How do we create that together? What do we know from our ancestors? And what do we want to bring forward? And so a lot of our work is about dreaming, is about creating collectively, not individually. And one of the things we also say at our organization is that wherever you are in your journey, we have a place for you. And what we mean by that is that we don't turn anyone away. We believe everyone has value, and that everyone is here to carry out a purpose. And so we include all people. And that's not always easy when you run an organization, right? Or run programs. Inclusivity takes work. And that work is worth it, we believe. And that's essentially the values of how we do our work and how we started to have the conversations. What do we need in our communities to create healing? And a lot of what we needed in our communities was connections to our land, connections to our culture, our history, to each other, as well as connections to services. And Dr. Mal Madrona, you've been really vital in a lot of that work. But really what we know people need is love and to know that they always have a place. And we believe that place can be Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness.
Indeed. And, you know, I was privileged to have known your father and to have had many conversations with him about his vision. And I suspect that wherever he is in spirit world, he's quite happy with what you're doing.
I think he has a hand in it, don't you?
I would believe so. Yeah. I would believe so. That would be his way, definitely.
Yeah, we had a long list. We created a long list. He had some goals, and really all the goals centered around his people, you know, centered around service, centered around love, really centered around not turning anyone away. You know, and what was interesting is when we planned, we had some time. My dad got sick unexpectedly, and he declined rapidly. So we had about 3 weeks with my father. While he was, you know, very solid in mind and had a lot to say, but physically he was not well. And during that time, we were able to do a lot of writing and planning. What I also didn't say is my father's an author, both a children's author as well as one for people who are more grown. And we wrote a lot and we talked a lot. And one of the things in preparing for his services, because he prepared them all, we listened to what he wanted during that time, was to be sure that we had his services in a location where those people that he would talk to when nobody else would, could walk there. So we had people who were living not in a home, but somewhere on the street. We had people that were actively using substances. We had people that normally are not welcomed in our spaces. And they were welcome there. They were welcomed at my father's celebration. And so that lesson of inclusivity, even at the time of his departure, going to a much better place, I believe, than he left, he wanted to be sure that all people had an opportunity to be there. And so I think, you know, you knew him as well. I think those values are very much Passamaquoddy and Indigenous values. And those are the values that get lost in systems of oppression, get lost in a society that unfortunately got its start on the backs of Indigenous people all over this world. And so it's a shift. It's a shift to what we usually see in that westernized world, that outside world. But I believe it's a shift that when people feel it and experience it, it's a shift they commit to.
Indeed. And it seems so important these days. I just read the annual Oxfam report about the distribution of wealth and the inequalities that exist in the world, and learned that during COVID, the top 1% became approximately 1,000% wealthier, and the bottom 50%, 160 million people dropped into poverty. So it was daunting, you know. So it seems in the context of looking at what's happening in the world, a la the Oxfam report, it seems incredibly important, you know, what Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness is attempting, you know, which I think is to create that equality in the face of colonial oppressive inequality.
Yeah, and you know, I want to dig into that a little bit. And I know you probably have a lot to say in this space. You know, when we think about the systems of oppression, right? The systems that were set up to help some in our society, and in some real, real ways, while helping those privileged in society, targeted, harmed intentionally and unintentionally people of color and other groups that we know are oppressed as well. And those systems, the tricky part of those systems, even though they're intended to privilege those few or the majority, they also harm that group over time. And I think about, you know, our spaces of education or, you know, in higher ed or even in healthcare, where we see a homogeneous group of people for the most part. And while medicine is shifting and we see more women for sure in that field, it's still more homogeneous than we'd like. And unfortunately, what that does is it doesn't allow for the true brain trust, right, in the room solving our most complex problems. So when Indigenous people, when those systems were meant to harm and isolate us from attaining what those systems had to offer, it allowed for very homogeneous thinking in those spaces. Not that 10,000 years worth of wisdom that you need in those spaces to solve the complex problems that we're dealing with. Some of those are in the medical setting. Some of those are in climate change, our world. And so when those voices, when those wisdom keepers are left out of those spaces, we're all harmed.
Indeed. And last week for my podcast, I interviewed Siseku Kumala, who is a South African Indigenous philosopher. And he was talking about this very topic, which is that the solutions to contemporary problems come from at least 125 years ago or further, and that settler colonial capitalism is just digging itself into a deeper hole. Yeah. And, you know, that we need the Indigenous wisdom. And he introduced me to two very interesting 19th century South African indigenous philosophers, about whom I never heard, of course, being in the United States, where we ignore the rest of the world. And it was a really fascinating conversation, but it gets to what you're saying, is that the wisdom for solving many of today's problems doesn't lie in the mainstream culture. Yeah.
No doubt, doesn't lie there. And you know, that shakes up the mainstream culture, doesn't it? We created systems to solve these problems. We created careers to solve some of our complexities. And I truly believe that, you know, even when I think about what we created with Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness, a place for healing and recovery, you know, what's providing the healing and recovery and providing the strength to stay away from substances is recreating opportunities to gain that wisdom, to gain that knowledge, to reconnect. It's never left us. It might be suppressed out of protection, right? But it's there. And where I see our folks healing, it's in creating, you know, nourishment, the food, you know, that people plant, and being able to be involved with creating real nourishment there, and also creating nourishment for themselves, feeding themselves, the culture, the language, all of those things that were our foundation, were our strength.
Indeed. And some people listening don't know that I actually work at Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness. And I think what makes the services special is the embeddedness in Indigenous values. And I think about the commitment to people that I see, and the compassion for people that I see, and the love for people that I see, and the emphasis on relationship. And as you know, in conventional medicine, it's primarily transactional. And you know, I give you something and you give me something and that's the end of that. But what I see in Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness is people building relationships and not giving up on others. And one of our colleagues, Sharon Toma Jordan, was telling me about how she had to report one of her clients to the Department of Health and Human Services about children. And she said, and it took 8 years for them to talk to me again. And I thought, well, Sharon, that's amazing, because you're still here for this person 8 years later and ready to serve them and you know, connect with them. And, you know, that's amazing. That's not going to happen at some of the more colonial institutions in our community, which I will not name. But I think this, and I'd like to invite you to say more about this, that really what's special about where we work is this practice of Indigenous values in everything that we do.
Yeah, it truly is leaning into love, always. Leaning into love even when it's hard, right? It's easy to love a puppy or a baby or chocolate cake, you know, but sometimes it's a little more difficult to have those same expressions of excitement and awe and love when you're faced with anger, you know, expressions of hatred perhaps. And that's what Sharon is good at, is leaning into love, And that's what we practice every single day, is you love first. And those values, and I do think it's difficult. I mean, there are probably some that are far more evolved than I, that are, they find it really, really easy to love always. And while I find it less and less difficult in moments of conflict, I still have to practice. I still have to be focused on, let me center, let me realize that I'm looking in to my eyes in that person. And we need to focus on compassion. We need to focus on love. And because that's what we would want for ourselves as well, I believe. And so that has really served us well. I think leaning into love and centering Indigenous values is the reason why our organization grew so fast. You know, these systems of oppression that I speak of, that both of us have worked in, many people have worked in, there's harm that's done being employed in a system that is centered on power. And how do we create places of employment that offer healing, not just to the people we serve, to ourselves? Because we've all been victims, whether you're Indigenous or not, to systems of oppression. We've created them everywhere. And I'm sure we all have stories on how that didn't work for us, how it created harm, how the relationships that were developed within those workplaces were based on authority, power, control, oftentimes. And here we say we love you.
Yeah, it's so true. And just a short example I can give you is, so recently we had a client who went to the emergency department and was poorly treated, thrown out, told to go away and never come back, and charged with criminal trespass, though she was actually in a manic phase of being bipolar at the time, which they didn't recognize because of prejudice, I'm going to say. And this client was no longer an alcoholic, but had once been, and her past was held against her. And she came straight away to Wabanaki on Park Street, as where many people know, and we surrounded her and got her case management and got her on some appropriate medication. And I think I've made 5 home visits now to her, and she's getting better and better. And the whole team coalesced around her to help her. And our goal was to keep her out of the emergency room where they don't treat her well anyway. And so I think, you know, that's kind of an example of Sharon's team coming together, coalescing around someone who's been treated poorly by the colonial system and making a difference.
Yeah, I mean, it is sort of common sense. When you surround people with love and support, they thrive. They thrive. And when they thrive, we thrive, because we don't do anything by ourselves. We were not ever intended to do this alone. We created that mentality. We created that mentality because if we didn't have that mentality of, we're supposed to succeed on our own, do it on our own, in spite of everybody else, then gosh, that would be a lot of weight to bear, to think about how we really created it, what we did to others to create that power and wealth and privilege. But the reality is we're not supposed to do anything alone. We're supposed to be here together. You and I are on this journey together. And I believe that the creator, the universe, whatever you want to call it, creates opportunities for us to come together and do what is intended, which is, I believe, to love and serve.
Indeed. And it was interesting that my South African guest from last week talked about the worst gift of capitalism is individualism.
Yeah.
So maybe that's a good segue into talking about the recovery house that is being constructed even as we speak. By constructed now, I don't mean physically, but I mean humanly.
No doubt. Yeah, so we created the Center for Wabanaki Healing and Recovery. The center was created out of dire need. We have generations of loss, generations of oppression, and we have generational trauma that's felt, that's been measured, that's present in each of our Wabanaki communities. And with trauma, and Dr. Mel, you can talk to this better than I can, but with trauma, with unresolved grief, with exponential loss, I don't think that there's any question why you'd have substance use disorder as a problem. Alcohol numbs. Drugs can put us to a different place of reality. And I don't know who wouldn't want to escape from a community where missing and murdered Indigenous women are ignored, even though we're the highest demographic of people who are murdered. The life expectancy in my community is barely 50 years old. 40% of our kids graduate high school. 40%. Statewide average over 90. So the question isn't, why would we numb? It's, I think, why wouldn't we choose a different way to heal? Different way to resolve those feelings? And I also think that that is because of a disconnection, an intentional disconnection that in this country, the United States, disconnected us from our culture, our language, everything that made us who we are. And we need to reconnect because we have substance use disorders in our communities and we're losing people every single week. And so the chiefs of our four tribal nations here in Maine, the Mi'kmaq, Maliseet, Penobscot, and Passamaquoddy, came together a handful of years ago and said, we need different opportunities to heal. We need different opportunities to resolve that grief. So we're not numbing or trying to escape with other substances. And so we started planning, bringing people together, asking people questions. What helped you on your journey? What did you need when you were recovering? What were your experiences in treatment when you were in treatment? And we learned, we listened, and we created. We created the Center for Wabanaki Healing and Recovery, and it's the first center of its kind east of the Mississippi, a center that's serving, you know, Indigenous people, many of them never seeking services before now. You know, you always heard that movie where they built that baseball diamond. If you build it, they will come, right? I never knew if that were true or not because I had seen situations in our communities where they built beautiful dental clinics. You build it, they will come. Well, guess what? The dentist never arrived. And the clinics are there. So I always had that story in the back of my mind. And what we have found is you build it the right way, the healing way, the indigenous way. Oh boy, will they come. People are ready to heal. I think people have always been ready to heal. The opportunities for healing have been minimal. We don't value that in our society. We value toughen up, Dr. Malmadrona. Toughen up. Come on, this is work. And it's done damage, profound damage. And so we created a center for healing that offers and will be offering all the evidence-based therapies that are reimbursable by insurance, and we meet the licensing requirements, and we are that good colonized organization we need to be, right? We can do that. And we can also center love. We can also center culture, language, and also create roles. That Dr. Malmadrona, as a medical director, has a role, an important one, and our elder on site has an equally important role. And together, they develop magic. They develop healing. So that's what we're creating, a multi-site campus here in Maine that's rural, that's right along the mighty sacred Penobscot River, sacred to the Penobscot Nation, one of our tribes. Right at the foot of Mount Katahdin, a sacred mountain that we have ceremonial runs every single year to the mountain. The mountain has always been sacred to us as Wabanaki people. That mountain, like us, has been here for over 10,000 years in what we now call Maine. And that mountain translates into our Father, who we pray to, our Creator. And that's where our healing is happening. And there's beautiful stories of how it all came together and how the perfect buildings and properties just landed at our feet. Perhaps there was my Father working.
I was just thinking that. Yeah. That would be Alan.
Yes. I mean, we have the properties. We're still in fundraising mode, of course. We need to raise the money. So we're entering into these healing spaces without debt. It was so important for my Father, without debt, when you don't have to owe someone to have a space, right? It's important, you know, where the land can truly be all because we determine that and not have to lease or not have to pay a note. So we're in a situation now where we're still raising money, but we have the property. We have the places for healing. So our people in recovery are active on those properties. We have close to a 50-acre property along the Penobscot River that has 40 campsites. So our men in recovery, they love to be on this land. They feel the healing on this land. This is traditional Penobscot territory that's been in the hands of non-Indigenous people for hundreds of years. And now it's with us. So there's camping and connection to ceremony there, as well as there's a healing lodge where cognitive behavioral therapy will take place, right? Mm-hmm. Or group therapies can take place. And at the gathering place, that multi-acre piece of land, I don't know, you'll see, I do believe, Dr. Mel, that I think the real healing happens there.
I suspect you're right. So I wondered if you could say more about your vision of culture, of how to bring culture into healing, because I know you've thought about that extensively.
Yeah. Wow. I believe culture is healing. I believe when you and I are sitting around with people making regalia, and we're talking about families, and we're talking about the regalia and the purpose and the meaning of what we're making. I believe that is what creates healing. so much more than any medicine that you can take. And how do we center that? How do we create that? We bring it into everything we do. So every program at Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness, every area, every department, we have 5 departments, even research, right? Even those other, even data or even finance, how's culture brought into this? And with healing, with recovery, wow, it's so easy. Because what we want to do is provide people with opportunities, all these choices to connect to different things that may provide them comfort, may provide them some healing. And so we believe in variety. We believe in choice. We believe that that's why our culture has so many opportunities. That if you are an athlete and you want to connect to culture more, well, hey, let's pick up a lacrosse stick. You know who are the creators of lacrosse? Let's talk about that and Wabanaki people. Let's learn. If you're an artist and you like to make baskets, let's talk about the importance of that and incorporating that into our healing circles. I believe healing happens outside a hospital. It doesn't happen within.
No, there's not much healing that happens in hospitals.
Yeah.
So I wondered if one of the things that came up is, you know, we're having a conference this weekend on two-eyed seeing, at which you're speaking, and it's been really exciting. But we, in our efforts to attract more local Wabanaki speakers, we ran into a belief that one shouldn't talk about healing publicly. And we had several confirmed speakers withdraw because of that concern. And I thought, well, that's interesting because the church doesn't have power over us anymore. We can talk about anything we want. Mm-hmm. But the belief was that, no, you don't talk about anything that has to do with culture or healing. And I wondered, well, first, I wanted to get your thoughts on that. And secondly, you know, what do we do? How do we move forward in the face of some people having those ideas?
Yeah. I believe that Indigenous people have been provided instructions for far too long. You can't do this. This is forbidden. This is not allowed. So I get a little, I feel it in my body. I'll say that, right? I don't want to say it's discomfort. I feel it in my body when I hear that something should never be done. You know, around culture, around healing. Indigenous people have been silenced for far too long. And if I believe that through my words, I could provide opportunity for others, Indigenous people, if I can talk about the importance that healing happens outside of a hospital and not within, if that can provide first Wabanaki people with opportunity for healing, I'm going to use my words. If it can provide non-Indigenous people an opportunity for connection and healing for themselves, I'm going to use my words. So I think we need to talk about the importance of culture and healing. That's our strength. That's our resiliency.
Yeah, and for me, it's I mean, it's the essence of two-eyed seeing is that we're equal participants in the conversation with the mainstream culture. Mm-hmm. And that we won't be silenced anymore, that we want to create ethical space between people and epistemologies, methodologies, but we're done with this hegemonic dominance of, you know, the conventional academic way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And the way we overcome that is by talking, is by saying what we want to do. I mean, publicly, you know, this is my belief, you know, and so I was disappointed that some people are not joining us to speak, you know, whom I would have loved to have heard because of that notion that you can't talk about healing, because I think if you don't talk about healing, it won't happen. That we have to talk about healing. And as loudly as the dominant culture talks about what they do, not all of which is bad, of course, but some of which is counterproductive to what we want to do.
Yes, that resonates with me fully. I do believe that there needs to be spaces for these conversations. We need, people are suffering. People are suffering because there's this imbalance, this focus on what makes us well and what makes us unwell. And we need to be voices in the room that ask the questions about connection. Ask the questions about how do you feel valued? There are different questions that we ask, I believe, are people seeking services than you would hear in normal medical settings, you know?
Indeed, indeed. Yeah.
Asking the person that might be moving into our recovery home, we might ask them, what brings you the most comfort? What helps you sleep at night? You know, it's those things that show people we care about really how they're doing, not maybe what their labs say or their blood pressure says or their treatment. It's just about how are they?
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things we've been finding is that we can get almost all of the information that's required for a standard assessment by doing a life story interview, by getting the person's life story, and which seems like a more indigenous way of getting a history than the pepper 20 questions one after the other sort of approach. And what's been interesting as part of the life story is one of the questions is when did you feel good about yourself? You know, what are some wonderful things that you've done in your life for other people or for yourself? You know, what's right about you instead of only what's wrong with you, you know, which I think is so important, you know, to balance, you know, all right, let's say you have a substance problem. Well, so what are the good things about you? What can we focus on that's really marvelous, you know? And,
you know, it's interesting because I'm sure there are, you know, methodologies or tools to help people in asking those questions about the life story. And when I think about our interviews that we do with every single person coming into one of our homes for recovery, those questions are naturally asked that way. And so it's just interesting to hear you talk because the questions that we often ask are, talk to us about what you do well. what maybe you can help others with and contribute in the home. You know, those strength-based questions. And I will say, in the beginning, those are hard for people. And often what we hear are responses like, I don't think I can contribute anything. I don't know what I'm good at. But it doesn't take them long. It doesn't take them long. With love and, you know, the services that we can provide for them to show exactly what they're good at. And oftentimes we know that just from our short interactions with the individuals where they're skillful. But I love the idea of a life story. I love the idea of a relationship. This is a relationship.
Right. And when you know someone's story, they come alive for you.
Yeah.
And I think that's really one of the joys, you know, of working with people is to, and it's so powerful for me because it's, I just want to tell them it's a miracle you're alive.
Yeah.
Given what you've been through. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just so impressed that you're even sitting here talking to me.
That's right.
And isn't that absolutely fabulous?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah.
Those are the conversations. Those are the moments of my day, I will say, where we have the opportunity, Dr. Mel, to bring the love in the room, right? And to love them enough to be there and have these conversations. And people report back. I've never felt that before. Everyone's left me, you know? And that's another thing that we're creating is one of the things we know with individuals that struggle with substance use disorder, that relationships also struggle through that disorder. And we can be a helping hand at Wabanaki Health and Wellness, Public Health and Wellness, to re-engage in those relationships, help heal relationships. And so we spend a lot of effort around family connections and healing across the unit. We're creating our first ever family and friends connection center that will be right in that same town where the other properties are. And it's a family and friends connection center that if I need substance use treatment, that I can connect with my mom and son, because there's a place for them too. So I might be in a different part of the campus, but they're on campus too at the Family and Friends Connection Center, that there's a place for them, because substance use disorder never just impacts a person with the disorder. That disorder belongs to the family, sometimes the community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So how are we healing across those systems? Mm-hmm. If you will. And so that's another focus that often is missing from the conversation.
Indeed.
And what we believe is the healing has to happen across.
So we're coming close to the end of our conversation, which has been marvelous. And I wondered if there's something else that you'd like to finish with that you haven't said that is just, you know, yearning to leap out and wrap this up.
Wow, that's big and open. So where do I go with this? You know, I think the biggest place I am at as somebody who leads an organization is how do I provide healing within that organization? And this is for people to think about who are in other organizations or lead other organizations. is that there's a lot of damage that can happen in the workplace. How we create our systems and structures, how we hear some voices and not others, how we practice inclusion or not. And what I have found is I am now leading an organization that creates spaces to dream, creates spaces to create whatever it is people want to create. And sometimes, because of what has happened in these other systems, dreaming is hard. Dreaming is hard because people are left to believe that dreams won't come true. I also come across individuals in my organization that have a hard time asking for help. That in other organizations, asking for help was seen as not knowing, and not knowing not being a skill, or not knowing being a positive, not knowing was a failure. And so why I share this is that I am now in a position of that reconditioning, that providing those spaces, and I'm learning as I'm going, that provides that healing to think differently, to be in relationship with one another, to love their colleagues. And it's hard because many of us are experiencers of that colonized structures, those colonized structures. And so I hope that people will think about how, when those systems don't work for a certain group of people or community of people, how do you create your own? How do you believe that you deserve that and create that so you're not within these structures that have created so much harm? I think if more people thought that, no, maybe they can't change the system, but they sure can dream and they can create. And I spent a lot of time in my career in those systems of oppression, thinking that I can change these systems or little tweaks here and there will make them more palatable for people from my community or people of color in general. And the reality is those systems are never going to be very palatable because they weren't meant for us. They were meant to keep us out. But what we do have is the ability to dream, the ability to create, and we hold the wisdom of some pretty rock star ancestors. And that's for everyone. That's not just Indigenous people. We all have rock star ancestors. And pulling from that wisdom, pulling from that change of mindset, that we don't have to be a part of systems that harm, we create new ones that serve with love, then there's more options for people, more opportunities to see that leaning into love will always be the way. You can't go wrong.
That sounds like a great place to stop.
Holy one, thank you. Holy one.